The following program from the North Carolina Reading Service is intended for our audience of blind and print-impaired people. It's the Indie Week, and I'm John Federson reading this week's issue. Indie Week is a weekly journal, and it's the date of publication is October the 26th of 2023. And a lot to cover, so let's get to it. Now, as we've mentioned before, the Indie Week is not only in print form, but primarily our articles are gathered off indieweek.com. And this particular one is web necessary. And so if you went to winindie.com, indieweek.com, you would find the best of the Triangle Awards, which are now being down to finalists, and you have an opportunity to vote for all sorts of, you know, a couple hundred categories, food, services, and the like. And you go to indieweek.com and look for best of the Triangle 2023, and there'll be an online ballot for you to fill out to your heart's content. And let's get to our stories. I'll start with the two articles in Indie Week concerning parenting. Both happen to come from Durham. One is local and one has statewide implications. Durham's Welcome Baby Program at Exchange Family Center offer new parenting workshop specifically for dads. New fathers have a safe, welcoming, and judgment-free space to sit, learn, and exchange ideas with their peers. NC Cooperative Education, that's a joint partnership between NC State, NCA&T, and various government agencies, recently launched this new initiative aimed at supporting fathers in Durham County. The Nurturing Parenting Program, that's a collaboration between the Durham County Welcome Baby Program and the Exchange Family Center, is a family outreach and support nonprofit, offer a 13-week workshop series that guides fathers through the importance of emotional and social health and gives them skills to foster strong relationships with their family and community. The first cohort began on September the 5th. Durham's Welcome Baby Program Manager, Patience Muship Mukulabai, says the system does really gear towards supporting moms more than dads, so we saw that gap in services. And she says, you come to class, you have 9 moms and 1 dad's. That conversation is more on mom's side. Now, Welcome Baby has offered parenting service to Durham families for 36 years, but nothing specifically for fathers. The program facilitators, Alfonso Blanco and Matias Murano, are native Spanish speakers with years of experience in parental coaching and family therapy, which Mushipe Mukulabai says builds common ground with the participants. Mushipe Mukulabai says these fathers are having a hard time assimilating. It helps that Alfonso and Matias also come from a different culture, so they can relate to some of what the dads are going through. The initial workshop is being offered in Spanish, she says, hoping the Nurturing Parenting Program can receive additional funding to run sessions in Spanish and English. The team could not secure funding in 2023 for the Nurturing Parenting Program, she explained, but decided to move forward anyway, since Blanco and Murano were already employed by Extension partner organizations. The most expensive budget item, salaries, was covered. The team had enough resources to launch their pilot program. And she says with a laugh, space, we have it. Family that need this, we have them. So you know what? Sorry to add to your load, Alfonso, but we're doing this, she said with a laugh. The Hispanic population continues to grow in Durham County, making up about 14% of the population as of 2020. The city and county have made efforts to welcome new people through City-County Immigrant and Refugee Affairs Initiative, but folks with uncertain immigration status may be apprehensive to engage with local organizations without building trust. Welcome Baby sees more than 100 families per week. The program has been able to leverage touch points with families that already exist, like the Giving Closet. That's a shop where residents can receive free clothing and baby gear, and to recruit fathers to this workshop. Mushipi Mukalabai says a lot of times people go where they feel safe and welcome. We have families who have been using our services child after child, so it's easy for the dads to come and feel safe too. Loneliness has been an ongoing problem for folks coming out of lockdown during COVID, exacerbating an issue that immigrants in Durham were already facing. Inconsistent work hours and long-distance work trips also make it challenging for fathers in the group to establish habits with their children or build relationship with others in their community. And Blanco said, one of the things that shocked us was how the male community, specifically Latinos, needs social interaction. They come from a different country. They work day and night. They don't have anyone who can relate. They have the weight of the family on their shoulders. And that weight can feel even heavier for fathers who did not have male role models of their own growing up. Murano, a parenting coach and family therapist with Exchange Family Center, says folks in the program are motivated to avoid repeating patterns they experienced in their own families, saying they grew up with only moms or grandmas. It's a pattern they're trying to change because they're worried about their kids. That's one of the biggest reasons they are in the course. Blanco and Murano agree the successful program means getting folks to come back week after week. Murano says, this program is exceeding my expectations. We don't know if someone's going to come because of their situation. Every session is like a relief when we finish. Now, the pilot program concludes on December 5th, and after this, the facilitators plan to continue meeting with the first cohort on a semi-regular basis to maintain those relationships as they bring in new fathers and caregivers to the program. And Mushipi Mukalabai says, we hope that when this first cohort graduates, they'll continue to come back and get emotional and social support. That way they know the help did not stop. The next article from NC Newsline on IndyWeek. The State Court of Appeals issued a ruling Tuesday that affirmed that the termination of a mother's parental rights, even though the child hadn't yet been born at the time of the mother's crimes, because, quote, life begins at conception. The mother had pleaded guilty to felony child abuse of another child, which prompted a lower court to terminate her parental rights. Appeals Court Judge Hunter Murphy wrote a 22-page opinion referencing a North Carolina Supreme Court case from 1949 in which the court held, quote, biologically speaking, the life of a human being begins at the moment of conception in the mother's womb. But that quote dealt with laws involving inheritance. The Supreme Court wrote in that same opinion, issued more than 70 years ago, quote, ordinarily a different rule or definition is applied as to when life begins, in tort actions and in criminal statutes. Murphy, a Republican, wrote the opinion. Judge Jefferson Griffin, a Republican, concurred. Judge Toby Hampson, a Democrat, concurred in result only, which means he agrees with the outcome of the ruling but not the reasoning outlined in the opinion. This decision sets a precedent for future cases involving parental rights and unborn children. The family of five included a mother and father, their child Roxanne, the father's daughter Wendy, and the mother's son Luis. In May 2017, they would become a family of six when the mother gave birth to Opal. Now, neither parent is named in the ruling, and the children's names are concocted for this article. The mother told a therapist that the father would hurt her emotionally and physically, to the point she had miscarriages. Durham County Department of Social Services opened juvenile cases for the children after an incident in 2016 in which Wendy was severely hurt. The mother, who was pregnant with Opal at the time, was later charged with felony negligent child abuse of Wendy. The father was also jailed on unspecified criminal charges. DSS removed Luis and Roxanne from the mother's home in 2017 and placed them with their maternal grandmother. The ruling did not specify where Wendy went. A month later, on May 8th, Opal was born, and within 2 days, the father posted bail and then was deported by federal immigration authorities. 3 days after Opal was born, DSS filed a juvenile dependency and neglect petition on Opal's behalf and removed the newborn from her mother's custody. Later that summer, DSS allowed the mother to have supervised visits with her children and had planned to reunite the mother with Opal. These plans would eventually change. The mother pled guilty to 2 felonies involving child abuse on June 27th in 2018 for the injuries inflicted on Wendy in December 2016. 6 months before Opal was born, and the mother received a prison sentence of 51 to 74 months, during which she would not see her children. The grandmother had custody of Luis and Roxanne, not Opal, but was able to have supervised visits with her. In 2021, the trial court determined the primary goal for Opal was adoption, not guardianship, and directed DSS to file a petition to terminate mother's parental rights. The mother unsuccessfully tried to get the trial court judge to recuse herself, alleging that the judge wouldn't give her a fair hearing. The judge previously had ruled against her, the mother argued, and had referred to the mother's actions underlying her conviction for felony abuse as, quote, torture. The Court of Appeals ruled that the mother did not present sufficient evidence that the judge could have ruled impartially. Murphy then turned his attention to whether the mother's parental rights should have been terminated. State law allows the court to terminate rights if the parent has willfully failed to pay child support for 6 continuous months before the petition is filed. And the law also allows the court to terminate these rights if a parent has, quote, committed a felony assault that seriously injures a child or parent in the household. The mother argued there wasn't sufficient evidence that she had willfully failed to pay for Opal's care. She'd held a job for 4 of the 6 months preceding the filing of the petition to terminate her rights and testified that she had contacted child support enforcement about paying child support but had never received instruction on how to do so. She also contested the notion of a household, arguing that Opal was not living with Wendy because Opal hadn't been born yet. But in his written opinion, Murphy held that even though Opal was still in utero, she was a member of the household. Murphy, whom the state Supreme Court censured for enabling in 2020 for enabling a toxic work environment in his chamber by employing a high school friend who made lewd and sexually inappropriate remarks to co-workers, wrote, in North Carolina, it has long been held that, quote, the life of a human being begins at the moment of conception in the mother's womb. During the time period within which mother was pregnant with Opal, inclusive of the last date of mother's offense, Wendy resided in the home with Opal and mother, end quote. Next article from Durham. J.J. Henderson resident Pearlie Williams gets her day in court. On Tuesday, October 3rd, Pearlie Williams, 63, sat silently in the front row of courtroom 4D at the Durham County Courthouse, waiting to be called for the final hearing of her arson case. Wearing a crisp cream pantsuit and a black cloth face mask, embellishing with the words, I can't breathe, Williams squinted against the harsh overhead light. Williams, who is partially blind from cataracts and glaucoma, has trudged half a mile on foot to the Durham County Courthouse 4 times since May. Her trials have been continued for a number of reasons. During her last visit in September, prosecutors said they couldn't contact California Commercial Investment Companies, which manages her apartment complex, to obtain the surveillance footage, quote, incriminating her. Charged with arson and threatened with eviction as a result, Williams has maintained her innocence. The possibility of losing her home has kept her up at night, though. Mentally, it is so draining, she said. I have lost weight behind this. I have lost sleep behind this. She'd postponed surgery on her right eye, hoping to be in the best physical condition for her final hearing. On two occasions, a car nearly hit her while walking to court. When the court went into recess, Williams sat on a bench in the hall outside the courtroom. She was the first to arrive that morning and wanted a break. She looked down at her lap, cried, and muttered repeatedly, "Do I look like an arsonist?" Williams has not touched or cooked in her oven since the beginning of the summer. In May, Williams, who has lived at J.J. Henderson's senior apartments for more than 7 years, burned a bagel in her kitchen. When it caught fire, she smothered the flames immediately and disposed of the remains in a communal trash room, she said. Days later, she was charged with arson. California Commercial Investment Companies, which manages J.J. Henderson, posted an eviction notice on her door, giving her 5 days to vacate. Williams said CCI's actions are a direct result of her complaints against the company. Last winter, Williams was quoted in articles published by the Ninth Street Journal and Indie Week, criticizing management in the aftermath of a late December blackout. Williams and the other residents said the blackout left them afraid, puzzled, alone, frustrated, and without vital medical equipment in the dark. Rafiq Zaidi, another longtime resident who complained to the city council after the blackouts, has watched Williams' case unfold. Zaidi said they really put her through a lot mentally. Every time she walked into a building, she didn't know what she would face. I don't know how she will recover from this. Williams believes her mental health disorders and criminal record made her an easy target for CCI. In 1995, she was charged with felony arson, but convicted of a lesser offense. Her record includes over a dozen misdemeanor convictions. Before this summer, she had not been charged with a crime since 2001. She said, "I was an angry woman back then, but I put all that mess behind me. I've served as vice president on the resident council here. Now, my reputation is on the line." 3 weeks before the hearing on October 3rd, CCI representatives called Ernest Smith, Williams' eviction lawyer, offering to dismiss the arson charges if she agreed to move out of her apartment at Henderson. Williams refused. She wonders why management didn't present the offer in May, before they strung her along for a series of continued court dates. She cried, "If they're going to nail me to a cross, they should nail me. They started this hellish mess. They need to finish it. They don't threaten me, not when I know I'm in the right." Though Williams intends to fight eviction and clear her name, she's unsure if she wants to continue living at Henderson. Williams said the property manager at the complex, Michelle Scarada, still does not say hello when they pass each other in the halls. Since July, she has paid her rent directly to the courts. The Ninth Street Journal reached out to Scarada, who did not respond to requests for comment. Henderson was previously owned and managed by Durham Housing Authority. In 2022, DHA announced the reopening of Henderson Senior Apartments after $31 million in renovations. With the renovation, new owners took over the building under a limited partnership. Though the Housing Authority still owns the land, according to tax records, DHA turned management of the building over to CCI. Williams says, "DHA no longer cares about the residents," said Williams. "They made the worst mistake when they didn't investigate who they were turning this building over to. Can you imagine the headache that residents experience?" In response, DHA spokesperson Alia Saunders said, "DHA strives to ensure all residents are properly housed and treated with adequate care. We will continue to work with our partners to create the best possible living environment and management experience." She also relayed a statement from CCI. Quote, "For the privacy of our residents and all others concerned, we have a policy of not commenting on individual legal cases and complaints. We appreciate DHA's partnership and we're proud to be part of the J.J. Henderson community." Williams' long-awaited court date began with a calendar call. For 40 minutes, Judge Clayton Jones oversaw first appearances and continuances. As legal representatives and clients conferred in the gallery, Smith asked to approach the stand and speak with the judge privately. Shortly after their conversation, Jones announced a 15-minute recess. Outside 4D, Williams sat dabbing her eyes and clutched her cane. She was about to stand up and go back inside when her two lawyers staggered into the hallway, smiling widely. Her public defender, Matthew Cook, said, "They dismissed it." He reached to shake her hand as she began sobbing. Because her eviction was contingent on her now dismissed criminal charges, her lawyers expressed optimism. Smith added, "We still have that eviction matter on the 11th, but this helps us tremendously. Thank you. Thank you so much." Williams wept and broke into prayer. "I can finally go back to my normal life." Days after the decision, Williams said she struggles to readjust. She thinks about cooking in her oven but can't get past opening it. Her final eviction hearing was originally scheduled for October 11th, but as of this week, it's continued until December. She's not convinced her fight is over. Williams said, "They went to extreme lengths, so I know they're capable of anything. It is terrifying to live under this type of management." There is an op-ed now by Nida Alam called "The Silence of Our Elected Leaders is Disheartening." She writes, "Growing up in a post-9/11 America, as a Muslim American meant growing up in fear. Being only 7 years old when a horrific terrorist attack wrecks your country is traumatizing enough. Now imagine, at 7 years old, being blamed for that attack. As my friends and classmates grew up, they would celebrate milestones and achievements like their first piercing, their first date, first kiss, and their first straight A semester. For Muslim kids, those moments were overshadowed by our first time being labeled a terrorist or the first time we were asked by our teacher to, quote, explain Islam and tell the class why Muslims hate America. Among Muslim Americans, these moments are so common they feel cliched, and yet I still remember them with the same burning trauma I felt as a child. Our families endured these moments in silence because who could we go to? All our leaders shared these sentiments toward us. In the eyes of this country, Muslims were seen as terrorists until proven innocent. Our parents persevered in hopes of the American dream finally reaching our families, in hopes that someday we would be seen and treated with full humanity and dignity. What seemed like genuine progress has proven this week to be a mirage. Decades of pushing back against the demonization of Muslims in our politics, media, and culture has been undone in the span of a few days. Our communities have watched in fear and heartbreak as Palestinians are dismissed as human animals and savages. Mixed with our grief and heartbreak for the innocent hostages taken in Israel and the innocent civilians killed in both Israel and Gaza is a profound fear because we've been here before. It is particularly disheartening to witness the silence of elected leaders in the most progressive district of North Carolina, a place that prides itself on diversity and inclusivity. In this district, the site of one of the most violent anti-Muslim hate crimes in the last decade, our member of Congress has remained conspicuously silent on Islamophobia and the plight of Palestinians. Such silence sends a message that the concern of Muslim and Arab communities are not a priority and allows hateful rhetoric to proliferate until it calcifies in people's minds, leading to horrific acts like the murder of a sweet, loving 6-year-old boy named Wadia Al-Fayoumi in Plainfield, Illinois. Silence allows hate to take root in our communities, and it has taken root far too long. The same rhetoric and hate that killed Wadia this week also killed my friends, Dia, Yusor, and Razan in 2015. How many senseless murders will be enough? At minimum, we must call it out Elected officials must condemn all forms of hate and discrimination, including both anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. Silence from those in power can be interpreted as indifference to, or worse, endorsements of bigotry. As the first Muslim woman elected to public office in North Carolina, I'm not afforded the luxury of silence because I must advocate for Muslims of all races, ethnicities, and cultural backgrounds. But we need all our representatives to stand up for justice and equality, regardless of party affiliation, political financing, or ideological beliefs. Ultimately, the millions spent by super PACs like AIPAC and DMFI to prevent any criticism of the Israeli government has created a vacuum of compassionate leadership. In the absence of measured, thoughtful conversations that reject both anti-Semitism and Islamophobia, conversations that these funders have prevented, hate, bigotry, and fear-mongering step in, dehumanizing Palestinians, Muslims, and Arabs, and leading to the violence that took Wadia's life. I want to be clear, any politician who has been complacent in creating that vacuum has blood on their hands. We can't turn back the clock. We can't bring back Wadia, Dea, Yusor, Razan, or any of the Palestinian or Israeli civilians killed back to life. But we can and must prevent more violence. It's time to acknowledge that leadership requires action. It's time to call for an immediate ceasefire and an end to the military occupation of Gaza and the West Bank. It's a time to demand an end to Islamophobia and anti-Semitism alike, because all forms of hate thrive in the same ecosystem. This is not a matter of politics, it's a matter of human rights, the very principles on which our nation was founded. They say that in situations of injustice, silence is complicity. But our elected officials aren't just complicit. By remaining silent, they create a breeding ground for hate. We will shout and sing and pray into the void until every child lives free of fear. Next article by Mark Pinsky. Scholars gather at Duke and NC Central University to celebrate the legacy of John Hope Franklin. On Tuesday and Wednesday, this was Wednesday, scholars will gather at Duke and NCCU to mark the 75th anniversary of historian John Hope Franklin's groundbreaking book, From Slavery to Freedom, A History of African Americans. When first published in 1948, Franklin's work joined W.E.B. Du Bois' 1935 Black Reconstruction, in challenging what had become the conventional wisdom among establishment white historians about the post-Civil War era known as Reconstruction. At the time, From Slavery to Freedom was published in 1947. The consensus was that Reconstruction was a corrupt failure, and it was a central element of the South's white supremacy myth of the lost cause. Fundamental to that racist trope was that the newly freed African-American men, in alliance with white Republican allies, were incapable of governing themselves. This willfully inaccurate misreading of history was supported by popular culture, by books and films like Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind. In fact, as Franklin and Du Bois pointed out, the opposite was true. This multiracial alliance, with its prospect of a viable two-party South, was largely successful until it was subverted by the terror of the Ku Klux Klan and fading political support from Northern Republicans. The keynote address for the symposium, which was free, was delivered on October 25th by Evelyn Brooks Higginbotham, professor of history and African American studies at Harvard, and co-author of the current edition of From Slavery to Freedom, which has been consistently updated since its publication for use as a textbook, including the renamed subtitle from Franklin's original, A History of Negro Americans. Speakers from NC Central include Dr. Lydia Lindsay, Dr. Jim Harper, and Dr. David Jackson. Duke speakers include Dukes William Darity, Samuel Du Bois, Duke, Samuel Boyce Cook, Distinguished Professor of Public Policy, and William Chafe, Alice Mary Baldwin, Distinguished Professor Emeritus of History. The sites for that symposium were appropriate. Franklin taught at NC Central, then North Carolina College, between 1943 and 47, and at Duke from 1983 to 1985. Duke University campus was the home of John Hope Franklin Research Center for African and African American History and Culture. A stretch of I-85 in Durham is also named for Franklin. In the decades that followed the book's publication and Franklin's follow-up, Reconstruction, after the Civil War, other historians who come to be known as revisionists, though in fact they were recovering the real record of what took place during Reconstruction, wrote books supporting Franklin's position. These included Leon Litwack's 1979 Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Been in the Storm So Long, The Aftermath of Slavery, and Eric Foner's 1988 book, Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution, 1863 to 1877. The latest addition to this body of work is Fergus Bordwich's new book, Klan War, Ulysses S. Grant and the Battle to Save Reconstruction. In his book, Bordwich tells a largely unknown story about how President Grant, goaded by radical Republicans in Congress, mobilized the power of the federal government to defeat the Ku Klux Klan's terrorist army, which once boasted 300,000 partisans across the South. The Klan's rampage of beatings, floggings, rapes, and lynchings was aimed at formerly enslaved African Americans attempting to exert their constitutional rights, chief among them, voting rights. Much of this campaign took place in North Carolina. Grant, with an army of federal prosecutors armed with a suspension of habeas corpus and backed up by bayonets of Union soldiers, broke the Klan, first in South Carolina and then throughout the South. Bordwich said in an interview following a recent reading in Chapel Hill, "The symposium of John Hope Franklin's pioneering work reminds us how tenacious the struggle has been to reclaim our history. Franklin fought early in numerous books and articles since to correct a prevailing racist view of Reconstruction in the South. By the early 1960s, as his views were attracting support from younger progressive historians, Franklin and the others were dismissed as revisionist by the American historical establishment." Next, Chase Pellegrini de Power writes about kindred spirits. "One Saturday evening on Main Street, a witch, a druid, and a Celtic neo-pagan walk into a bar. This isn't the setup for a joke. The three friends had come to downtown Durham Bar Arcana to celebrate a special occasion, the 10th anniversary of the Triangle Area Pagan Alliance, the largest public pagan organization in North Carolina. With a DJ, costume contest, and cash bar, the anniversary party didn't look too far off from any other group of friends hanging out, though there may have been more pentacle jewelry than in an average crowd. Aaron Karcher, owner of Arcana, said, 'They're just the sweetest community.' Though she's not a pagan, her underground and tarot-themed bar has proven to be a welcoming space for those who are. Amanda Morris, social worker by day and coven member by night, is one of the original founders of the group. She says it started simply as a group of friends enjoying meals and drinks together. The alliance to her is about community. She is saying, 'We just want to talk to people about the cool thing that happened this weekend or be in a safe place where we can be openly pagan and know we won't be harassed.' Morris is a part of a coven of Wiccans who, instead of celebrating American establishment holidays like Christmas or Hanukkah, follow the Wheel of the Year. That's a calendar that in its current form dates back to the mid-20th century and is based on ancient celebrations in the cycle of the seasons. Each sect, practice, or tradition of paganism has its own holidays and celebrations. There's no easy definition of paganism. Google, in fact, warns that the term is outdated and possibly offensive. But Morris doesn't find the word offensive. She explains pagans tend to believe in polytheism, ancestral worship, or a deep connection to the natural world. Quote, "We're not a unified community, and we're not a unified religion at all." The Alliance helps solidify community support that others may find in a church congregation. "It's sometimes about just knowing that you're not alone," she says. They may support friends in need by helping out when someone is sick or getting a gift card for someone who's had a tough time at work. It's hard to know how many pagans are in the Triangle because many people are private about their beliefs, but Morris says they're everywhere if you know where to look. She says we definitely have several Wiccan covens. We have heathen groups running around. We have some druids. We've got a mix of folks. North Carolina, a Bible Belt state in which 77% of adults identify as Christian, never had witch trials as extreme as those in Salem, Massachusetts, but pagans still feel like they are pushed to the margins of society. Some forms of tarot and fortune-telling were even criminalized in North Carolina until as recently as 2004. Morris says there's a good chunk of people who are scared and they're worried about losing jobs. She points to the satanic panic of the 1980s when unsubstantiated fears of ritualistic abuse ran wild. No one in the Alliance worships the devil, she says. Actually, according to Morris, many pagans don't even believe in the devil in the first place. Mary Hamner, a witch and scholar of religion at UNC Chapel Hill, points to Christian norms as the cause of the stigma. She says something like contemporary witchcraft or paganism looks crazy, but it's because we've all grown up with this backdrop of Protestantism. The Alliance seeks to combat some of this stigma, sometimes by something as seemingly inconsequential as just existing in public. The group's social calendar looks almost impossibly normal, including a writing hangout at Barnes & Noble, a hike at a state park, and a meet-and-greet at Arcana. For Hamner, the emphasis on inclusivity extends beyond religious norms. She says, "I think a lot of pagans and witches, magical folk of all types, see themselves as kind of being in between and beyond the status quo. I feel like that is also a queer experience." Inclusivity is part of the story of the queer owned and operated Arcana, too. A sign posted at the top of the steps to that basement bar reminds customers to be respectful and welcoming to all people. Karcher says this is why the Alliance seemed like a natural partner for Arcana. Quote, "The thing I pride myself the most on is getting the feedback that we are a safe space, and that extends to women, the queer community, trans community, people of color, and pagans." Hamner, who's working on a book about witchcraft, has spent time studying how elements of magic from corners of the internet have crept into the mainstream, even slithering into corporate boardrooms under labels of manifestation and actualization. And Hamner says, "If you've heard people on TikTok or even in corporate culture talking about if you just change your mindset, good things will happen to you, it's rooted in some of these earlier new religious movements, but we don't think of that stuff as religion anymore." She credits pop culture and spaces like at Witch Talk, the mystical corner of TikTok, with increasing people's exposure to non-traditional and polytheistic ideas. When she was young, she was bewitched by mid-1990 depictions of witches and magic through films and shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Charmed, and Practical Magic. From there, she navigated her way through Wiccan chat rooms and do-it-yourself websites until she eventually founded her own coven and became a formal member of a tradition. It wasn't a phase, she says with a laugh. Sorry, Mom. The anniversary party at Arcana in September was also a fundraiser for the Alliance's coming winter solstice party. Like other December holidays celebrated by North Carolinians, this party will be a time for celebrating friendship, family, and new beginnings on the longest night of the year. Morris said, we invite all the groups in the area, old friends whom we've not heard from in a long time. They'll celebrate another year, underground, in the shadows, together. A cultural article now, in fact, a classical music article, written by Sarah Edwards back in October the 5th. Earlier this afternoon, this was October the 5th, Triangle Classical Music Station, WCPE, 89.7 announced it will air the entirety of the New York Metropolitan Opera's 23-24 season, a reversal of their contentious decision announced last August that it would decline to air six of the season's Met operas. Deborah Proctor, station director, wrote that the objectionable operas were, quote, written in a non-classical music style that has adult themes and language. Other concerns cited in the letter included suicide, death, and, quote, non-biblical sources. Music director Emily Moss told Indy the following week on Thursday afternoon, a meeting, the station had decided to reverse course. She said, we are a refuge away from politics and the mess and trouble of society, and we want to just provide beautiful, soothing music. And that's what we're going to focus on. Moss's invocation of the station as a refuge echoed Proctor's defense of the decision earlier this week. In an NPR interview, Proctor described the censorship as necessary to preserve WCPE program as a safe refuge from the horrors of life. The letter, which also contained a 20-question survey, was mailed out to listeners in August and picked up traction in late September when it was posted to Twitter. Over the past few days, a spate of coverage followed, with reports from NPR, CNN, and the New York Post criticizing the listener-supported station for editorial criteria that seemed, at best, arbitrary and inconsistent. Proctor told NPR, I have a moral decision to make here. What if one child hears this? When I stand before Jesus Christ on Judgment Day, what am I going to say? This meaning explicit operatic content. WCPE's scrutiny of the season coincides with the Met's effort to diversify it and feature more works from outside the white male canon. The list of operas originally rejected includes Dead Man Walking, Florence A. Amazon X, The Life and Times of Malcolm X, Five, Fire Shut Up My Bones, El Nino, and The Hours. Of those works, three are written by people of color. Online, critics have pointed out that other Met operas permitted by the station also include explicit content. WCPE plans to air the Puccini tragedy, Madame Butterfly, for instance, which tells the story of a 15-year-old's sexual exploitation and ends in suicide. Romeo and Juliet, Turandot, and The Magic Flute were all on the approved list of operas the station planned to air. Founded in 1978, CPE reaches more than 180,000 listeners across the Piedmont. On social media, many wrote that they plan to cancel their support of the station. Listener Caitlin Wells wrote in a letter that CC'd the Indy, your vision describes expanding the community of listeners worldwide, but you are refusing to allow those without financial access to a broadcast to join in appreciation of these recent new works. You are also excluding valuable new works about great modern thinkers, artists, and leaders like Malcolm X, Virginia Woolf, and Charles Blow, all of whom happen to be queer and or black. Nevertheless, the station has felt that the backlash was unwarranted. In a link to the survey as of today, that's October 5th, WCBE front page website copy stated, quote, several hundred news articles have been published nationwide misrepresenting the contents of this document. Please click below and compare the accusations in the news with what was actually published. When asked to detail results of the survey or comment on what the station felt had been misrepresented in media coverage, Moss declined to comment. She said, we listen to our listeners and we value their opinion, and we're listening. Caitlin Wells, that letter writer, told Indy over the phone, opera is all about these heavy life or death topics and wrestling with the ugliness and beauty of life simultaneously. You don't have the one without the other. I honestly can't think of an opera that doesn't deal with that. Emily Trivette writes, women's cricket finds a foothold in the triangle. The feet of 22 women pound the turf, batting, bowling, and running in the first ever USA Cricket Women's Regional Championships in 2021. The Sun baked the players on a historic day for women's cricket in America, and Badiraju reveled in the cool bliss of playing with her daughter for their country. She never thought it would happen. Badiraju said, it was like my dream come true. To be honest, it's the best feeling I ever had. Everybody thinking, mom and daughter are playing on one team? Wow. When Badiraju lived in India, her greatest desire was to pursue cricket. But for the time she was there, the most acceptable ground for women to play cricket was on a neighborhood street. Today, in America, Badiraju's past inspires her daughter Bhumika to play on. I just felt like I was doing something that she wasn't able to do, said Bhumika. So that's what resonated with me. The Badirajus are only a small part of a recent surge in cricket, a sport most comparable to baseball. Yet cricket is a more finely tuned, complex 42-rule version of many field sports. USA Cricket says more than 200,000 Americans play cricket. And one of the sport's liveliest communities is Morrisville, North Carolina. Badiraju and Bhumika first played together in 2017 and were joined by a handful of other mothers and daughters, excited by the Triangle Cricket League's promotion to try a few women's practices. It's still kind of crazy, actually, said Mitali Patwardhan, one of the first girls to join the Women's Triangle Cricket League. That's the TCL. It's been like 5 years now since we started playing, and there's already enough women interested, at least in our area, to have this many teams. Yet the growth is relative. 73 women are registered to play with WTCL. The men's league, formed in 2010, has about 3,800 players registered. It was the recommendation of cricket coach and analyst Rohan Gosala that created a space for women's cricket in the area. Gosala said, in 2017, and a year before that division was formed, we need to start women's cricket so that in future, when the women start playing, slowly the girls will start playing, and maybe after 4 or 5 years, we can see the results of that. In the same year, USA Cricket brought a blast of life to the American cricket community by winning the Audi Cup, a North American men's cricket tournament between the U.S. and Canada, for the first time in 26 years. That energy carried over into the formation of WTCL. However, both Gosala and WTCL coordinator Rupali Ulal emphasized that the growth, past and future, comes from the girls and women who hunger to play. Ulal said, in my mind, it's all about providing an opportunity. If someone wants to play, we're going to make sure you're going to play. At the heart of the surge lies a handful of mothers and daughters. Three of the original five under-19 players attend school at UNC at Chapel Hill. Patwardhan, Bhariraju, and Geetika Kudali, the USA Cricket U19 captain and member of Team USA. Nearly all the under-19 women spent their childhoods on living room floors watching cricket on televisions in India and America. their mothers and others, who make up the senior portion of the league, spent their early 20s and 30s playing cricket on the streets, frustrated by social barriers that blocked competition for them beyond the local neighborhood. While the under-19 women are riding the first wave of American women's cricket, most TCL senior players remember the 1990s, when cricket was a rarity. Senior TCL player Supriya Desai said, "When I came here, there was nothing. No cricket at all. Forget about women's cricket. There were no men playing either." When Desai moved to Cary during the 90s, she wanted to bring together her community of other immigrants from Karnataka, India. Before the North Carolina League, playing at picnics with other Indian immigrants fed the life of the sport in North Carolina. When five original TCL women began playing cricket together, each about 13 or 14 years old, they played on boys' teams because there weren't enough girls to form a full women's cricket team. Patwardhan said, "Let's say you're like entrusted with the responsibility, like a crucial part of the game. They kind of expect you to screw up already. So if they give you one chance and you like it, don't do so great, they don't give you another chance for a while." Going from softer balls to the cricket-regulated tough leather balls and against boys who'd been playing since they were 8 years old, the women were starting from square one. It was discouraging, almost pushing Patwardhan to quit cricket for good. She said, "Part of my reasoning was everyone was a guy and I'm the only girl. Why would I do this?" Then once the women's league started, I was like, "Wait a minute. So everyone's like me. This might actually be kind of fun." The sheer presence of women's teams in America, recreationally and nationally, signals a hopeful shift in the social dynamics of cricket. This wouldn't just be good for the women playing and their fans, but for all in the cricketing community who want to see the sport achieve greater recognition. Cricket analyst Nate Hayes notes that the overall cricket growth in the country will be stunted without more women involved, especially since 10,000 female players are required for the sport to be even considered as an NCAA sport. Hayes says this points out how much harder it is for women to play cricket than men. They don't get the same opportunity, the same schedules. They don't get the same priority, and here in the United States, that's especially true. Women's cricket aside, America is in a unique rung on the international rankings ladder. Hayes said that USA Cricket either dominates in every tournament they play, or they're completely decimated. Very few teams are in the same spot as USA Cricket because the program is still so fresh. Prior to 2021, there was no women's presence on the national stage of cricket, and now there's both a national women's team and a U19 cricket team. According to a recent GeekWire article, a $120 million investment was put into USA Cricket in May 2022, and even more recently, it was announced that cricket will be played in the Los Angeles-based 2028 Summer Olympics for both men's and women's teams. There are about a billion people in the world who play cricket, watch cricket, and support cricket in every way they can. And Gosala said, "Why I'm invested in this is because I always felt my mom didn't have an opportunity or an environment where she could grow in cricket those days in India. Not many people know that about me." Not much chance to read this entire article about the novelist Zelda Lockhart, saying her characters have deep generational wounds, but the work doesn't stop there. And this was in relation to a book release on September 21st at Barnes & Noble in Durham. To prepare for her latest book launch party, Zelda Lockhart had all the regular party stress: snacks, invites, decorations, in addition to a team of contractors desperately trying to finish the classroom and stage she was building on her property. "We're trying to get things set up and the contractor is still screwing in the door," says Lockhart. "The other contractor is screwing in the benches. It's going to be interesting." Lockhart, 58, moved from Hillsborough to Durham last year. In November, she began the process of converting her yard and the front third of her home into a workshop, her Story Garden Studios. That's a space where Lockhart will lead workshops for black women to heal through art and nature, and it will hold its first meetings later this month being September. In the workshop, Lockhart, who holds a PhD in expressive therapies and a master's in literature, will guide women through writing exercises that helps them process and heal from trauma. This process is exactly how she wrote her latest novel, Trinity, which follows three generations of a black American family from the late 1920s through today as they fight to unravel the pain of their past. A prologue outlines the initial traumatic event in their family when an ancestor was kidnapped from Ghana and enslaved, but most of it happens during the last 100 years, beginning with Benjamin Lee, a victim of child abuse who grows up in rural Mississippi. And the fade-up of the music is to remind everybody that I have to come to a close here on this long article about this author. And you can find this and other articles that I wasn't able to get to if you go to IndieWeek.com. So this is John Federson for the North Carolina Reading Service, where this program is available as a podcast after this broadcast. Thanks very much, and we'll be with you next week.